Hello and welcome to today's program of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club and your host for tonight. Our program tonight is iPad Revolution, the future of digital publishing. Our speakers are Matt Carlson from Hot Studio and Matthew Davis from Zinio. I'd just like to let you know a little bit about our speakers first. Matthew Carlson, Principal of Experience Strategy and Design at Hot Studio, and Matthew Davis, Director of User Experience at Zinio, were involved in designing some of the first digital magazines that launched on the iPad on April 3rd, 2010. They spent the last year exploring new ways to experience and engage with magazine content on this exciting new platform. Together, they've worked on iPad editions of magazines such as Spin, Dwell, National Geographic, Car and Driver, and many others. So our first, we're going to have each speaker is going to speak for about 15 to 20 minutes, and then we're going to take questions and answers from the audience and have some discussion between the two of them and me. But I'd like to let you know our first speaker is Matthew Carlson, who is Principal of Experience Strategy and Design at Hot Studio. Matthew works with clients to create compelling brands, products, and services that integrate customer insights with breakthrough technology. Matt brings 15 years of experience in branding, interactive, and experience design to his role at Hot Studio. Throughout his career, the focus has been on mapping customer journeys and envisioning ideal experiences. At Hot Studio, he explores how well-crafted experiences can activate the relationship between companies and their customers. Prior to joining Hot Studio, Matt was Principal Brand Experience at Continuum, a global innovation consultancy. At Continuum, Matthew worked on experience strategies for a diverse range of clients such as Harvard Business Review, Sprint, Nextel, CVS, Pfizer and Pfizer, the Center for Creative Leadership, Sunbeam, and Intercontinental Hotels. He's worked across media from wine labels to websites, products to packaging. So let's introduce and give a hand for Matt Carlson here.
Hi, everyone, and thanks so much for the Commonwealth Club for hosting this event tonight and giving me and Matthew Davis an opportunity to talk about something that we're really, really excited about. One moment. So tonight we're going to talk about the iPad revolution and the future of digital magazines. I've been fortunate enough for about the past 7 or so months to take a dive deep back into the world of magazines, which is like one of my first love, and probably since most of you showed up here tonight, I think something that many of you might be very passionate about as well. What I'm going to talk about today is kind of take a walk you through a story of the creation of a pretty innovative app that was designed purely to read magazines and present great stories, and then we're going to hand off and we're going to talk about that relationship to those stories. But I'm going to start here. Our story begins in a secret room with papered windows and two top-secret prototypes chained to a table. Those were, of course, iPads. The time was somewhere around mid-February 2010, and Zinio had been chosen to create one of the first apps for an iPad. Specifically, their deep, rich history with presenting magazines in different formats for either on desktop or iPhone had allowed them to have that opportunity. The opportunity here was huge. They had offered, magazines in those different formats, and they were going to be one of the first companies to be able to offer a magazine on the iPad. And being in San Francisco or the San Francisco Bay Area, we realized the degree of sort of hype and interest that comes out of anything that is announced by Apple. So Zinio turned to Hot Studio, my company, to help them design it. Here's the challenge. It was to build a complete, fully functioning app in about 6 weeks. So on top of that, to figure out how to port about 2,400 magazines over to this new format, and to do it again and again and again every month into the future. On top of that, we had to figure out how to make maybe six of those magazines really special, something that would behoove being on such an innovative new platform. And along with that, we had to, figure out, what was the future of magazines going to be like, and maybe, let's just rethink what reading might be like while we're at it. Here's the upside. The upside is you get featured in one of those wonderful, positive, clean, minimalist ads with someone saying, hey, there's an app for that. The downside is if you fail, you get deported to Seattle, and then you have to work to Microsoft for maybe, you know, 5-10 years until you can come back. Not that there's anything wrong with that. Me and Matt have spent time in Seattle, and that's why we're in San Francisco. So here's what it takes to build an app from scratch in 6 weeks. There were 5 people from Hot Studio who were deeply immersed in user experience, the design of user interfaces, and who loved magazines. There was another small team, our counterparts from Zinio, who really knew publishing inside and out. There was an international team of Cocoa developers. In case if anyone doesn't know what Cocoa developer is, it's basically what you should encourage your children to get into. It's the newest form of engineering that is specifically for Macs and Macintosh devices. Also in the mix, we had 3 mad scientist HTML programmers who had a really poor idea of work-life balance. We had a hands-on CEO without whom we probably wouldn't have been able to get this done because he was literally involved not every step of the way, but on a lot of the steps, and brought a fairly enlightened light touch to the process. There was lots of coffee, lots of dry erase markers, lots of whiteboards, and also probably about a case of Red Bull. Once again, see the HTML programmer. I should mention that the HTML programmer who did work on this project is now in Louisiana because, you know, there's Katrina and the BP oil spill, but that's relatively mellow compared to designing apps for Apple, I would imagine. This was the bunch of people that we basically locked in some very small rooms for about 6 weeks with, like, constant disruption, requests from Apple, many sort of dramatic changes, requests from the publishers. And at the end of that time, right before launch, we you know, there was that final big push, and the app became live. Zinio has hovered usually in the top 10 or top 20 under applications offered by Apple in the iPad store. And, you know, we managed to get it released on April 4th with a big sigh of relief. So there are 2 big questions that we asked at every step throughout the process. And I'll let you know that, like, the strange new thing of designing or building an app is you build it, you get it out there, and you're like, whew, that's done. But with us, it wasn't done. Like, as soon as something launches and as soon as the first review lands in the App Store, it's basically back to the drawing board. How can we make this better? There's no way in 6 weeks you could get everything right. So it's much like a very more iterative kind of, okay, how can we repair this? How can we change that? How can we make this thing better and better? So we've been asking ourselves basically for about the past 7 months, what is the ideal magazine experience? What is something that can connect to the people who really love magazines and might be interested in technology, as well as the people who really love technology and digital consumers? What will bring them back to falling in love with magazines again? The other thing we asked about is what form should stories take? How should stories evolve to take advantage of these new mediums? How should stories begin to get multidimensional? So today I'll be talking about the ideal magazine experience and spending a brief amount of time talking about that. And Matthew Davis is going to then begin to get into an exploration of how stories may change or how stories, our relationship to stories might grow in the future. Part 1, the evolution of magazines. I'll start off by why this is all important or why this is going to potentially affect all of us. I'll step back a little bit. I first learned about tablets in about 10 years ago in all of my science fiction novels, where everyone was walking around effortlessly with like superpowered computers that were wafer thin and talking to them, operating them, and tablets were like the ways that people were interacting with all the digital technology. Now it's like that little bit of future has crept into our lives. And here are a couple interesting figures that aren't from science fiction novels, but really more from, actually literally from the pages of the Wall Street Journal. The first is that 13% of all consumers have expressed interest in purchasing a tablet in 2011. Another is that the rise in tablets and how exciting people find them has actually sapped the sale of laptops, netbooks, and other sort of small, light, portable computers. Morgan Stanley, although, you know, maybe we shouldn't trust Morgan Stanley's estimates, but They estimate that iPads will rise to about 30 million, while other tablets will skyrocket to more 20 million. iPad's not the only game in town. Every other major electronics manufacturer is trying to rush their own tablet to market for this Christmas season. And lastly, the iPad is now on sale in Walmart. iPad, Walmart, iPad, Walmart. Two words that you probably wouldn't expect to say together very often. That's a pretty good indicator that if something is rolling into the shelves of Walmart, that it's gone mainstream. And it's very likely that we're going to see even more of a proliferation of these devices out there. So what makes tablets so great? First off, they're mobile. You know, they're light enough and easy enough to carry anywhere. They're, if you guys, most of you live in the Bay Area, you've probably seen them. They're becoming more and more a staple of the morning or evening commute as you see people reading them on the way to work. Another is they're personal. iPads, it's easy to buy tons and tons of fantastic, quirky little apps that are designed just for you or to do just what you want to do. If you're interested in cooking, there's recipe apps. If you're interested in solitaire, there's definitely tons and tons of games you can play on these things. There's basically an app that's been designed for really most pastimes that people are interested in. And they're so cheap and so easy to get that that means that everyone's iPad has basically become their own individual this sort of easy to use computer. You see people treating these things or talking about this stuff. It's not uncommon to for Matt or I or anyone you run into to what ones do you have? People treat them like they're trading cards. They're interested in seeing what other interests other people have expressed. Next, they're high fidelity. There's a lot of beautiful pixels that are packed into these screens. iPhones and iPads have better screens and higher resolution than the computers we use. So it makes it perfect for the display of digital content. And lastly, these devices, not just iPad, but touchscreen devices, are intuitive. You touch something, it moves. You flip a page, the page flutters around. These devices make the manipulating information much more tangible, make it feel much more real. And you can see this if you hand an iPhone or an iPad into the, hand one to a toddler. They'll figure out how to work the thing right away because they touch it, it moves, and it's easy to learn and kind of understand from that sort of play-based learning. For the magazine industry, these were the holy grail because they offered basically the right form factor, something that felt approximately like the size of a magazine. They offered that in big, beautiful color. They could reproduce content that would be just as beautiful as the content on a page. They were designed for recreation. These things are not great for data entry or for spreadsheets, any of you who have tried that. They're really great for consuming things, for browsing social media, for sharing with friends. And lastly, they're connected. So you could basically download a magazine from anywhere in the world. That was that means that you don't have to go to the newsstand. You don't have to mail in a subscription form. You can really subscribe or get magazines from anywhere. So what happened when the iPad launched is there were thousands of designers, creative directors, editors, and writers all over the United States many of whom were designing for something that they had never touched, never seen, or never held in their hands. Because, as I mentioned, there were a few top-secret prototypes hidden away, and everyone else had to sort of guess, I think it's going to be kind of like this. I think you're going to touch it, and it's going to move over there. It could sort of do that. And so what you saw was an explosion of magazines that actually began to look like many things other than magazines. Some of them looked like websites in the upper left corner there, you're seeing the next incarnation of Gourmet Magazine. And some of you might be familiar, Gourmet Magazine has actually gone out of print, but it lives on in these interactive formats. So that's and that's the form that they chose to take on the iPad. Net-a-Porter is a fashion magazine that actually lets you shop straight from the application. So it could be really the future of fashion magazines. Most fashion magazines are basically one big, beautiful ad followed by another product placement followed by another beautiful ad. Now, this is a magazine that you could actually shop from. And the last is the last magazine is Popular Science, which took one of the most avant-garde and sort of progressive takes on what a magazine should be like in this brave new world. Another thing that people began playing with was new architectures for what a magazine could look like. There were, rather than just a linear flipping through pages, some magazines chose an approach where if I swiped a page, I would go to the next story, and then like blended that with a web metaphor of scrolling up and down to read the full story. Some magazines chose to completely deconstruct all the objects on the page. Popular Science, the example, the beg, borrow, wheel over there, you can actually touch anything on that page and move it around. It ends up feeling a little bit like a Rubik's Cube, but it's pretty innovative. And other magazines chose to, when you know, on turning the orientation from going to landscape or to portrait, to actually change the way that you read, going from something that felt more like a magazine to switching to a format that was closer to a Kindle, where you could resize the type, read it any size you want. So it was creating magazines that actually had different, much different forms, depending upon how you chose to read them. Another thing that many magazines did right upon launch of the iPad was look at ways to bring rich media into the experience. So taking all those outtakes from the photo shoots got turned into beautiful slideshows that could create a more visual experience of reading a magazine. You can actually now, if you buy a copy of Rolling Stone on the iPad, you can actually listen to the songs that it's giving reviews for. So it's beginning to incorporate some of the things that you would expect to find in a music magazine. And, of course, you know, video began to play out. You can, you know, get an issue of Car and Driver, Road and Track, and watch a video from behind the wheel. So rich media was starting to play into these experiences. Of course, with all this complexity and all this innovation, people were moving sometimes faster than the actual readers could catch up. So, you know, another staple of the digital magazine on the iPad has unfortunately become the instruction manual. You know, telling people, okay, touch that to read, swipe this way to read that. You know, basically, these magazines had to come with a quick start guide so that people didn't get lost in the experience. So this is the baseline of what magazines, some of the magazines that have launched and some of the first wave of magazines that have digital magazines that have made it onto tablets. So far, there are many elements that will, you know, all these magazines, the mix of the complexity that they brought and the rich media they brought, it was interesting and innovative, but still most of them really lived more in the realm of feeling like a CD-ROM. None of them had fully realized the potential of what a magazine could be in a digital format or began to really connect to the other digital experiences that people really loved or enjoyed. So in order to, as part of the process of continuing to innovate or define what a magazine should be or could be, here are some things that the next generation of magazines, the next wave that you're very likely going to be seeing pretty soon, will be doing. One is, and we'll walk through each one of these, the first is to be connected. Very few magazines at this point have taken full advantage of the fact that iPads or tablets are actually pretty high-powered computers that are connected to the internet. So the next step will be seeing stories that actually go beyond the page, connecting you to additional information, additional reference that you might not be able to get out of the print magazine. Next is the notion of being customizable. You should be able to do, and we'll actually move through these like one by one. So I'll go to the connected first. Here's a latest issue of Harvard Business Review with a great article about leadership lessons from the military. This is from this magazine, you can actually launch into reading more and more references or stories from Harvard Business Review's website, as well as take, you know, comment directly to the blog that is connected or supported by this article. So instead of just reading an article on a page, you can actually click through and go to be part of a conversation around the topics that are espoused in that article. And you see this play out, you know, here's Harvard Business Review, but you know, the same thing is happening in 17, where teens trade advice about the social pressures of high school, you know, linking from the magazine to those sites. Mary Claire, Us Weekly, it's basically become a really great way to finally connect the magazine to the more interactive websites and the other content experiences that we enjoy in other places. No magazine yet has done the step of really allowing you to do what you can do to a print magazine. A print magazine, if you like a recipe, you can tear it out. If you're a teenager and you like a rock band that's featured in Rolling Stone, you can tear it out and paper your walls with that. The next step of digital magazines will actually be taking this trend and allowing people to tear out the pages from individual magazines, save them to your own, create your own sort of mashed up collection of all these clips, and have that as something that you can really make your own or keep beyond any single issue. This is actually a website that we discovered when doing some work for 17 Magazine. And if you have a teenager, basically 17 Magazine had many, their audience had basically a wide range of teenagers who really liked the site called Polyvore. All Polyvore does is allow you to, it's basically you go there and it's like a big stack of clips of fashion magazines from all over the world. And teenagers spend a lot of time just arranging these things into beautiful collages and then sharing them online. So this is a trend that in the next, you're probably going to see this carry over to the next range of digital magazines where you'll be able to take these, take the magazine experience, tear it apart, recombine it, and make it your own. And lastly, to be really effective, the next phase of digital magazines should be shoppable. Here's an example from Marie Claire's A to Z app, where they've dismissed the structure and the form of the magazine entirely and just basically created a big, beautiful collage of all these products that arranged from A to Z that you can touch one, go see it online, shop directly from the app, and use that to... it's basically created a, probably a fairly true magazine experience where you can, where the magazine is basically, you know, down to its core. So here is like a an example from the Marie Claire A to Z app, where touching a product would actually jump straight through to a shopping experience, and you could, you know, from looking at a magazine, you could go purchase a product and make it your own. Lastly, to become meaningful, magazines need to become social. Here are a couple shots from an application that called Flipboard. Flipboard basically took blogs and RSS feeds, basically all the stuff that a lot of the internet is made of, and took that and actually brought that content back into a magazine format. So basically all it is like a blog where you flip the pages instead of scrolling down the page. And that became wildly popular. People realized, hey, I'd rather read this content, whether it's from Facebook or Twitter or from any of the blogs that I like, when it's presented like a very beautiful magazine. And the last step that magazines are going to be moving towards that none of them has yet captured is this notion of being able to tell a magazine, I like this, go find me more of that. And you, this trend has happened, if any of you use Netflix, you're probably familiar with, like working through a process of expressing your preferences, saying I'd like this movie, I would like to see more of that, and it comes back with lots and lots of recommendations. Or if you use Pandora or iTunes, it'll do the same thing. I like this song, show me more songs like this. The next phase of magazines is going to borrow from this notion of being able to learn from what a reader likes and offer up more content that will fit that. Here are a few things that that I just want to leave you with before I hand over to Matthew Davis. One is that tablets are becoming a dominant new form. And chances are, in 2011, if you match the predictions, one of these things might you might find it a tablet of some form, be it iPad or something else, showing up in your house or your work, because a lot of people are beginning to adopt them to the workplace as well. Both readers and publishers are going to be converging on this new form, this new way of interacting with the internet and reading information. And because of that, magazines aren't necessarily going to die, but they are going to be radically transformed by this process and by the needs of this of people to kind of connect both the print magazine with the interactive realm. Lastly, it's going to lead to people connecting to stories in new ways. And with that, I'm going to end my piece, and Matthew Davis is going to carry on.
Thank you, Matt. I'd like to remind our audience listening at home that this is the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is iPad Revolution, the Future of Digital Publishing. Our next speaker is Matthew Davis, Director of User Experience and Creative at Zinio. At Zinio, Matthew works to bring compelling digital content to the broadest possible set of media consumers through product and interaction design, brand, and consumer insight. He has followed Zinio's evolution into a global product with an online presence in 30 countries, in 15 languages, and into a mainstay in digital publishing with the introduction of the iPad. Matthew brings experience in brand engagement, internationalization, mobile product development, and creative and professional writing, having worked in various capacities for Microsoft and other companies. Following his studies in English and political theory, it's an interesting background, huh? At the University of Oregon, Matthew began his professional career editing dictionaries and encyclopedias. He has a zeal for rapid ideation and synthesis, human interaction design, language, and design. He admires the printed word and enjoys a spirited dialogue on the evolution of digital publishing and new media. Matthew Davis.
I got to adjust it. That's the tall mat. So you can tell us apart. There we go. Okay, how many of you guys have iPads out there? What? See, I predict Apple will sell 250 million iPads in 2011 based on that research. It's going to be incredible. Did everyone vote? Yes? Okay, not enough of you. That's okay. Still. Okay. Let me see where I am here. Okay, so I think Matt Carlson, tall Matt, sometimes called Hot Matt, talked a lot about how the tablet is an agent of change for magazine publishers. And Zinio, who I work for, has always known that we actually began with the idea that we were going to build tablet computers back in 2002. And we were working with IDEO to create a tablet that would look something like, in 2002, the Ten Commandments. It was going to weigh about 75 pounds. It was going to be 4 inches thick. It's going to be a spectacular. We, of course, kind of changed gears. We were waiting ever so patiently for this device to come to the marketplace. And so obviously it's been a great sea change for our business, and I think it's going to be a great sort of paradigm shift for the publishing industry. And where I pick up really is, as he's spoken so articulately about the magazine and the iPad, is I believe in something a little smaller, which is the story. So the magazines are changing, and there's a lot of people, and you might hear this, it's sort of a stock and trade for people to talk about this struggle that the publishing industry is enjoying right now, and that's something I'm going to talk about a little bit. But I want to talk a little bit about why magazines matter. I've mentioned that you can't crowdsource a novel, and bear in mind, I'm a digital media consumer. I have blogs that I follow closely, and I most of my information is very personalized and very particular. But there's something I should say about, let's take for example the 24-hour news cycle, where really what we have is a lot of information, which is where news happens, where we're reacting to things that happen. But there's, when I look at the magazine, I think about where stories are synthesized, where kind of ideas are given meaning and where we're given taking perspective. And maybe for the conveniences of my argument, I'm talking about The Economist and not a gossip magazine. But I believe that there's a connection in people and the way that they see their world and see their society and long-form journalism and editorial content and curated content, which I think maybe the magazine is the highest form of. And I think that there's something else where if you think about a publisher's website, which might just be novel and maybe doesn't capture the beauty and the fidelity and sort of the curation of the printed page, it's images, it's typography, it's the way that we use style and design not only to make a magazine beautiful and stylish and likable, but also to create a hierarchy of ideas, to create brand loyalty and identity. And I think that's something that's very special about the magazine. So conversely, I think there's a lot about the magazine that needs to be changed, and probably most primarily, I don't think that the magazine has really anything to do with the way that contemporary media consumers access information. And that's to say, a magazine, my favorite metaphor here is the idea of a magazine that's wrapped in plastic, is this sort of closed book wrapped in plastic and put on a shelf. You know, if you go into a Barnes & Noble, you might find that, you know, people are like digging into the plastic like raccoons at the shelf, you know, little scraps of plastic everywhere trying to read an article. And I think that to me is a powerful metaphor for an industry that relies on the idea of scarcity and that relies on this closed book and people dedicating to this closed book which in my mind is very much at odds with the way that we all have learned to expect to find our information, which is fast, free, personalized, immediate, anywhere we go. Really think about what the value of not just digital media is, but what the whole internet is. So if you really look at what's happening in the publishing industry, and I call this, I think it is the writing on the wall, and this is certainly a really robust conversation with whomever it involves. In the first half of 2010, following a two-year trend where the publishing industry lost, in some cases, 9% of their circulation, we're already down 5.8% in circulation for the first part of 2010. Paid subscriptions dropped 2%. Continuing ad pages and magazines dropped 4% in that same time frame. This is sort of an opportunity where we have the publishing industry seeing some painful statistics, and that makes a lot of people look for a heavy object to grab. You know, a lot of people kind of go to what they know, and a lot of publishers are seeing this as a big opportunity and are looking at the tablet as maybe it's a little closer to the Ten Commandments. It is some sort of salvation that they're seeing. So what are these magazines facing when they want to, so if a magazine wants to have efficacy with a new kind of consumer, I think they're seeing digital consumers, a typical person, maybe I'm on the edge of this, but a lot of young people who might be their target audience who have never bought a single issue of a magazine and never subscribed to a magazine. That would have been a total abstraction a decade ago or 20 years ago, and today that's not an abstraction at all. Their reader bases are changing, so you might be losing your readers to new media and to new forms of media. And I think, lastly, advertisers, and I think for the longest time, the publishers were sort of kings in media, and I think the advertisers are kings now, and I think the story has moved to the advertisers, and advertisers have a lot of power. So maybe my favorite analogy here is with the RIAA, which the recording industry. And if you guys think back just a little bit to Napster, I don't know, whatever happened to that. And you look what happened in the music industry. And in 2004 to 2009, total retail music declined 30%. And there, what you had in 2004 with Napster and Lars Ulrich, wrestling match. And you had these MP3 things coming around, very crazy, very scary things, file sharing and peer-to-peer sharing. And the recording industry basically had a response, and the reason I refer to pipe dreams is they imagined that the CD, which really came to the marketplace in 1983 and didn't change for 25 years other than that they continued to drive down manufacturing costs for the CD and increase their increase their revenue, they imagined that consumers ad nauseum were going to pay $20 for that same CD. And that was just going to go on forever, and they were just going to have bigger and bigger and bigger boats. I think that something like at that time we were selling 30 to 40 billion compact discs a year. Don't quote me on that statistic. What happened is that this agent of change came in, which was the MP3 and which was digital music. And you had an industry that looked at it and said, I have a great idea. Call our lawyers right now. And that was pretty much their whole response. And so I look at an industry that's faced with a high rate of digital change and a changing sort of marketplace, and an industry that really blanched, didn't react, but a lot of people did. One of those companies is Apple. So let's jump forward a little bit. Talk about rapid rate of change for digital music. In 2003, you had less than 50 licensed music services. Now there's more than 400. If you look at the catalog that was available from a paid music standpoint, there's a million. I think that statistic over here should say there are 11 million tracks. If you go over here to licensed music services in pure revenue, that was $20 million in 2003, and now that's a four and going on $5 billion a year industry, which is paid music. And that's to say that here's the idea of paid music in 2003 not even showing up, and that's now 27% of the retail music industry. Apple, for instance, and iTunes is 75% of all paid digital music and 25% of the entire retail music industry, and that happened in a really short amount of time. And so, I suppose if I jump forward a little bit. What I see in this parallel is an industry that's facing the same sort of change. I feel like their business model is jeopardized, their medium is threatened, everything that the publishing industry has come to trust about their business model in all this time is under a lot of attack. And that's when I begin to think about, so when I look for this parallel, I say, well, what made a company, a great company like that emerged out of this, like Pandora, or more lately Spotify, or iTunes for that matter, what made the alternative to litigation and DRM, what made an innovator here? And I think an innovator is a technology company or an innovator who comes in and looks what consumers want, looks at what consumers are looking for, and finds it, and finds a way of mapping the technology to the change and to the sea change and the way that consumers are behaving. And so when I see the magazine, we go back to those magazines with plastic on them, this sort of closed book, this brand that might appeal to one sort of broad target of a reader or a demographic, rather, but not to an individual reader. I say, what are the lessons learned? So I want to talk a little bit about the story as part of this the life cycle of a magazine, really, which is when you have all these talented people who create the magazines we love, and they sit down and they create the book. Stories are, and again, I'll use long-form journalism, I think it is the synthesis of visual design and layout, of great writing, of timeliness and themes. The very kind of urgency and periodicity of magazines is something to acknowledge. The idea that, you know, we're going to hear about the midterm elections today on CNN and we're going to hear something, but then we're going to see it 2 weeks from now in Mother Jones or The Economist or The Atlantic, and we're going to understand what happened. We're not just going to know that it did. And I think that in the print world, all this enormous energy goes into these magazines for really what is a short shelf life. And of those 10 magazines that go and sit on the shelf at Borders, two of them are going to sell, or three of them are going to sell, and the remaining 7 or 8 magazines, they're going to have the labels cut off, they're going to be sent back to the publisher, and they're going to end up in a landfill, or they're going to end up being recycled. And I think that's really sort of a tragedy if you love, I suppose, information as much as I do. Moving forward, what happens when that magazine leaves the shelf? I mean, like I said, in the worst-case scenario, it's in a landfill. In a slightly better scenario, it's been recycled, thank goodness. And in the best-case scenario for the back issue of that magazine, it's sitting in one of these familiar-looking folders in a public library, or it's in a box in your garage with a bunch of cleaning products. The same story that I'm talking about, which can be about the things that you love, it's your society, it's art, it's history, it's really where I think if news breaks on the New York Times, I think stories live in magazines, and then those stories die in said garage. And so what I want to talk about a little bit is how we can take what's amazing about curated content and magazines and editorial content, and what's amazing about digital media and information, and what kind of synthesis we can arrive at that lives with the best of both worlds, which doesn't like a website lose the fidelity of the printed content, and doesn't like a magazine provide such a barrier to entry and live in such a closed environment. And I think that when we have this conversation, and this is a great conversation that we're having with our publishers and the publishers that we work with, and Matt Carlson has had the same experiences, there's a lot of excitement about this. When we look at a reader who, for instance, might never be interested in reading Esquire magazine or GQ magazine, but they want to read the September 2010 issue with some 10,000-word piece on the escalating war in Afghanistan. So that's not an Esquire reader. That's a person who cares about foreign policy, a person who cares about Afghanistan, not an Esquire reader. So what else might that person read? What other stories do they care about? And how can we synthesize those ideas in a high fidelity and a beautiful format that preserves what we like about the magazines, but that gets us out of that closed book again? And so in this world, in the world I'm talking about, we can get magazines. If we can get out of those magazines, out of those pages, what happens then when you talk about, going back to what Matt Carlson talked about, is where then do those stories live? They live as frame of reference on blogs and on Twitter and on Facebook, where people can say, I read this story and I liked it. You can share that story with someone you know who cares about it. And most importantly, you should be able to find other things that you like, not under the banner of a publication, but based on the themes that are in that article, or the themes that are represented by how you read and how you discover information. And so to me, here's maybe my favorite metaphor. We had this when we talk about the BP disaster, as I call it, not the Gulf disaster. We have we can see it in long form journalism in The Economist. And this is a person who can arrive not because they committed to subscribing to The Economist, but because they know it's a reputable source and they care about this information and they're ready to dedicate this article. What happens when that person looks a little closer, right? So I want to read more about this. Where does this live? What's the perspective in Science magazine? I want to read about ecology. I want to read it in Rolling Stone, and I want to look at its impact on the midterm elections and on the balance of power. I want to look at it from the, let's say, Canadian perspective, because I'm potentially Canadian. I'm going to look at it in Surfing magazine, because I'm a surfer and I live in the Gulf. And so, to me, what I want to paint a picture of is not just how how digital magazines and how the iPad can help publications appeal to their existing reader bases and turn print readers into iPad consumers. I want to take a world of digital consumers who know what they want and know the kind of information they care about and make magazine content and high-fidelity curated content appealing to them. And I think that it's a sort of reversal for the publishing industry who's losing readers and losing advertisers potentially and whose audiences are changing, who aren't even looking at these screenagers or digital natives or whoever you might call them, people that don't care about their brand and don't read magazines. Well, we want them too, because if you're not ready when you wake up on a given day to subscribe to a digital magazine, but you care about the San Francisco Giants or the midterm elections, or you care about science and news and sports and fashion or all those things, I think that there's a home for you where ideas are beautiful and curated and filled with they're carefully edited and fact-checked, and content is presented in a beautiful way. So I do see this as sort of a new narrative. That's to say, this whole process by which the publication is made, where we make these enormous assumptions about who our readers might be or who our potential readers might be, needs to change. And we need to look at, as we talked about with advertisers moving on, advertisers finding more about their targets from other sources. So part of the reason why the magazine industry doesn't control that dialogue is because they can't give advertisers the same sorts of consumers that other mediums can, and I think that can change with digital reading. And I think that, and I'll echo Matt Carlson, when we talk about how these stories are packaged, I don't think a story, for instance, if you're a periodical that surfaces every month, I don't think that you should only have a once every 30-day interaction with your reader. If you start looking at how stories can integrate online properties and blogs and message boards and user-generated content, I think you can create a lot better interaction with the consumer and more interactions with your readers. So I think that this is my challenge, I suppose, both for what we try to do every day and what I see the publishing industry needs to do, is to look very carefully at what happened, for instance, with the music industry, and not figure out how you can cram your business model and cram the assumptions about your business into this new arena, but how you can recognize what people need and recognize how people want to access information and accommodate it in a way that I think and I hope can preserve all the things that we love about magazines. And that's all I have to say.
Okay, thank you, Matt Davis, and thank you, Matthew Davis, sorry. It's generally Matthew and Matt is what I'm told. So thank you, Matthew Davis and Matt Carlson. I'd like to remind our listening audience that this is the Commonwealth Club of California. You're listening to the iPad Revolution, the future of digital publishing. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club. And now we're going to turn it over to the audience for questions. There is a microphone over here on my left. I do have a question for you, though. So what kind of process and team do you really need to do this kind of work? You guys, can you, maybe each of you guys can talk from your experience.
I think the process that it took, or the things that were, getting back to how the app was created and how in 6 weeks we stepped into that, into a process where we were able to actually come out with something that worked. We actually did more drawing on whiteboards and trying to come up with layman's terms for things than we actually did spent on design or programming or any of the actual development. I think the biggest challenge when you're working with a broad range of very different people and you have to get something done really quickly is finding kind of a common understanding and often getting up and drawing a picture so you have a blueprint that the team can really work against. That was a central part of the process.
Matthew?
Yeah, I thought it was kind of like taking a dinner plate and hitting it with a hammer. There was no order. I mean, usually every publisher that we work with brings a different set of expectations and an expertise to the table. You'll find that the solutions that appeal to a book like National Geographic, which is like a photo journal and is very high fidelity and photo-driven, versus the Economist or versus every publisher brings with it its own assumptions about how they want to talk to their readers and how their brands might live in a digital environment. And they bring with them a highly variable discipline for the digital medium. That's to say, we have publishers who are ready to try anything and are excited for us to take the lead. And there are others who have been working with their web teams and with third-party resources for years or a decade or longer who feel like they have it handled. But I think I would begin by saying, really, we like the sort of deconstructionalist method, where if you look at the magazine, not in its print form, but you look at it not at the gestalt, but for all of its parts. It's the articles. It's how people navigate the magazine. Do you have linear readers or non-linear readers? We like to talk about all those things and put them out flat on the table and see where the publisher wants to go.
Great. Thank you.
Can you move your mic a little closer to your mouth?
Okay. Okay, good. Thank you. I want to make sure everybody can hear you very well in the back. Okay, we have our first question from an audience member. Go ahead, please.
Yes. This question is for Matthew Davis. So if you were running a magazine right now and you have sort of one foot in the old age, you're still dealing with people who are touching physical pages and like to sit there perhaps and read the whole package, but you know you're also worrying about the digital natives. What about this question of process and personnel? Would you have two teams of creative people, one thinking about print, one thinking about the new realm? Would you have a team that's holistic and is thinking on two different fronts, or is it all one thing?
It sounds like you are making a magazine. You can tell me if you're making a magazine. Okay, he's making a magazine. All right. I think that the wall between the digital group within a publisher, big or small, and the editorial folks and the circulation, I think some of those walls are pretty arbitrary. And I think if you're a magazine publisher and your focus is on print, and all the people that are working on your digital properties are outside of that room and outside of your core competency, that you're probably making a mistake. Either you're assuming that too little about your user experience and your readership in the print world and that there's too little in common between the two mediums, or you're betting against the efficacy of the tablet. But I think even what I've seen at a lot of publishers this year is that the web guys from some of the publishers who at some point would be like the bad news bears within a publication's organization are suddenly at that table again, and they're trying to solve real business problems and trying to build the future of those magazines. So I think obviously the way you build a team is different on a case by case basis, but I think I would challenge that most publishers should be looking at having an integrated team who knows how to solve problems universally. The best example being what you've seen with a lot of publishers who have kind of rushed to put something on the iPad. They've spent $500,000 on one single issue, and it comes out 2 weeks after their print issue. It's reductive. It has fewer pages. I think that's something that's not very well thought through. I suppose, in short, I would argue that that there should be more harmony. There should be more love between these two organizations.
I know this was an app project, but I'm wondering if you had conversations. I'm curious if you had conversations about publishing on an app versus publishing on the web, and maybe related to that, publications that are device dependent versus device independent.
Is that an argument about building a digital magazine in a native application environment versus making a magazine, for instance, with HTML5 and WebKit?
No, more just where it lives. So if it's available on your iPad, through an app, or simply on the web. And I know the boundaries obviously blurry, but
right. Just curious. I think we can both answer. Matt Carlson.
One thing that when we launched the Xenu app on the iPad, we had to come up with a solution that would work, as we mentioned, for about 2,400 titles. So some of these titles were extremely tech-savvy and had some pretty robust digital properties, and some of them really just wanted to allow the equivalent of their print magazine make it onto this format. What we did, or what we allowed, is a solution that would kind of work across all the different instances, was allow that basic kind of version of the same magazine that you would get in a newsstand when it went onto the iPad or went onto the iPhone, layered different types of interactive experiences on top of that. So in each instance, whether it was on a tablet or a laptop or the an iPhone, you'd get an appropriate experience for that device. It's really hard to read a long-form story on an iPhone or to see the full fidelity or beauty of print on an iPhone. It's really great to just kind of snack on an iPhone, read a little bit of information. So the approach there was to put content on there that would be best for that. And then as you get towards things that are higher fidelity or have a more beautiful screen or that people are likely reading in more of a leisure environment, that's where the interactivity got a little bit more robust, the actual magazines got a little bit more robust and beautiful.
Right. I'd say you're dealing with two real problems there. The first is if you're talking about designing for multiple devices and multiple form factors, I think that the publishing industry has a luxury that they'll only be able to enjoy for a very small amount of time, which is that the iPad is here. There's only one of them. Everybody loves it. It's 4x3. It has a 9-inch screen, and it's great. What the problem is that if you build a digital magazine in iOS and as a native application, suddenly in about 2 months' time, with this, we all call it this explosion of Android devices hitting the marketplace from virtually every OEM on the planet, from 7-inch devices to 9-inch devices with 16:9 aspect ratio, it's sort of a new nightmare. And I think that's the first problem that I think publishers need to start talking about. And I think that publishers, for instance, who have spent the last year really gearing up on Cocoa and iOS development and gearing up on their relationships with Apple, might find this landscape more difficult to manage, not only because so much about the Android marketplace is so fragmented right now, but because of the devices themselves. And I think that the other real challenge there is the fact that because magazines are periodical, that if you're not designing a solution that scales, you're not designing a solution at all. So don't make content for your iPad. Don't make big investments in content for a magazine on your iPad that you can't use as a web property or that you can't use as a smartphone property and that doesn't have any longevity. I don't think it's a safe investment in a magazine that you have if you're Rolling Stone and you're a bi-monthly. I don't think it's a real safe investment to build something really beautiful in Cocoa and have it have 2 weeks of sunlight on the iPad and then disappear into a similar kind of obscurity. I think that publishers should be looking at creating evergreen content that will always be beautiful and always be interesting and that will live well whether a person's reading it on a smartphone or a tablet computer or a PC or otherwise.
Okay, thank you. Next question, please.
Matthew, you sort of touched on this in terms of the deployment of content on various devices, and I was curious about the sorts of tools that, say, a Xenio, that Xenio specifically provides to publishers for, say, authoring. You've got like a design tool. You have like a design team. Perhaps they're used to designing print. I guess maybe, what tools do you provide?
Well, there's some of that I can talk about, and there's some of it I can't. I think you've identified a real strategic hurdle for our business. Like I said, we have about 2,500 magazines that are in, I think, 40 languages. We have readers in about 200 countries. We have dailies, weeklies, bimonthlies, quarterlies, books, textbooks. It's a struggle. It's a struggle because the publishing industry has itself tried for years to create a standard that would help them get their print content in sort of variable digital mediums with Prism XML, but it's not a broadly adopted standard. Mm. And so for the time being, here's what I would say. I'd say that we have two solutions. The first is while I think standards emerge, and I think that I hope that that Zenio, our business, will be an agent of those standards. While they emerge, there's going to be a lot of hand-holding. That's to say, the best experiences are made when great technology partners and design partners and editors work together on solutions. But there really isn't a single catch-all solution that works for everyone. One of our technology focuses this year is to not require, as I mentioned earlier, a magazine to kind of create from the ground up every issue of their iPad edition. We want to take those files, those InDesign files, and move them and be able to basically, we call that liquid content, you know, to break that content down into smaller pieces and make it distributable on iPhones and iPads. But I would say that technology, both at Zenio and in the broader competitive landscape, is emergent. There's a couple of, I think, some great solutions. There's companies like Woodwing, who I think worked on Popular Science, Time Inc., a combination of Adobe tools. I would put it this way. Zenio's made a real commitment to help our publishers find scalable solutions for their digital editions. Mm. And I think this year will be sort of our debut into that being a core part of our software services solutions and strategy. But we, along with the publishing industry and everyone else, are kind of waiting for a lot of this to shore up. And I think that's. Do you have anything further to add to that?
No, I mean, really quick. I think it's a process where, as Matt mentioned earlier, that the people who design print magazines are finding themselves playing in this new realm and beginning to explore interactive content. And so it's been a process of coming up with what are the tools that are going to help them understand and publish for that.
Yeah, and I can say, I mean, we work closely with Hot Studio, and part of our arrangement together is we, for instance, working with a number of our publishers, began by creating a series of information architectures. A typical print magazine has about eight or nine sort of templates that it uses for all its issues. If you look at them side by side, 8 issues in a row or 10 issues in a row, you can really see that. We want to imagine what that looks like and what information designs look like for digital editions that sort of parrot that will create familiar user experience metaphors and repeatable user experience metaphors and designs. For instance, you might see a sort of a lightbox solution or some interactive content featured in a digital edition will be a recurring feature in the magazine. And once we build that once, oftentimes in a mix of Cocoa-driven front-end and HTML5, the publisher has that. It's part of their toolkit. So every time they want to talk about, look at more photos, see the behind-the-scenes video, see what people are saying on our blog, they should be able to repurpose those same utilities in an ongoing way.
I have two questions. The first concerns you use the example of National Geographic versus The Economist, and The Economist is definitely almost like a PDF read, and the National Geographic is a very interactive experience, and you can view the videos and so on and so forth. The National Geographic recently, I think, released an app which is basically a Zenio. It takes the Zenio content and puts it in their own. Do you see publishers starting to release their own apps then for each of the their different magazines? And then I'm going to have a collection of 100 apps, or am I just going to be going through Zenio and you'll be licensing the technology to these publishers?
I think you should work for Zenio. Wow. I'll take that. I think you have probably a lot to add to that. I think that what we've done right now is we've created a kit that allows a publisher to create a co-branded application that extends a lot of our user experience in a really scalable way. Mm-hmm. And that means a publisher, not to give you the sales pitch, but that means it's something of a turnkey solution for a publisher who wants to have an application on the iPad with their brand mm-hmm. in the marquee. And so that's right now we're doing that with a number of our publishers, and I think there's some more coming to the marketplace. And that really is a problem of discoverability in iTunes. So there are a lot of people who know and love Zenio, and there are a lot of people who don't know Zenio yet, mm-hmm. and there's a lot of people who know National Geographic.
Right.
And so for National Geographic, it's a great sort of entry point for their readers. For Zenio, it's a great way for people to understand our reading experience and kind of get on our platform. All of our entitlements are cloud-based, so when a person, you know, buys it and is entitled to it in one environment, they own it in the other. But to really answer your question, personally, I wouldn't want to have an app for every single magazine I care about. I don't think that would work if you were doing it with ebooks. If you open up your iPad and you're like, let me see my ebooks, and you had like 240 applications for each ebooks, or an MP3 was an app, or an album was an app, I don't think that's a good user experience. So I'm hoping that some consolidation will happen there, and I think it will. But just the same, you know, publishers are excited about the iPad, and they want to be on the iPad and see their magazines on the iPad, and we want to help them.
Thanks. And my second question concerned the discussion today has been mostly about magazines. Obviously, you do offer newspapers as well. Few, I think there were a couple of German ones I saw last time I was checking for what's available. But how does the discussion about newspapers compare or contrast to the discussion about magazines?
Is that for me?
Both.
I think that's for you.
Really, I think the focus that we've been trying to do is make sure that newspapers are an entirely different creature. That's something that needs to cycle even more frequently than magazines do. I think what we're trying to make sure is that the notion of long-form content, great editorial, great curation of content, this notion of what a magazine is, lives on. So I think, you know, through our work with Zenio and through what Zenio has been doing is that we've really tried to be champions of the magazine to make sure that this notion of sitting down to a story that lasts longer than an average sort of Twitter tweet is still a pleasurable experience and that it's still relevant. And so that notion of relevancy, the way that we're striving to make magazines continue to be relevant is by like hooking in or layering in all these other different interactive experiences to them so that they begin to, you can share them, you can layer interactive content on top of them. We're really, when you're building a magazine, that's something that's a much more intense competition with other online or website types of resources. It's hard to...
Right. I'd say our focus is on high fidelity content for a couple reasons. The first is I think that the fidelity of magazines being photoreal and the attention to detail and style and typography is part of what makes a new representation of them so colorful on a device like the iPad. And I think that the newspaper, as much as I love the newspaper, it breaks down a lot easier. So I can read a newspaper with a dozen different sort of RSS readers because you can read and enjoy what a newspaper is argumentatively in plain text. I feel like a lot of great companies, there's an app for that, as I suppose what I mean. And so we've kind of dallied into newspapers before, and we have great solutions from a production and fulfillment standpoint. But I think there are some great folks in that space. If you look around the news space on the iPad, you'll see there's some really great solutions for newspapers, and it just hasn't been our focus.
Thank you.
So you paint an interesting picture with the Economist article linking off to different perspectives in different periodicals, and but the technology for that has existed for years on the web, and it hasn't happened. So I'm wondering why you think it's going to happen now with the iPad, and whether there are any platforms emerging that are going to enable that and allow publishers to monetize that experience as you move from one to another.
Well, the first thing there is there are a lot of – the publishing industry is driven by ads. Everyone knows that the magazine is really a vehicle for advertising. In many cases, advertisements make much of the substance of a magazine. So that might be less true for National Geographic, but it's really true for Vogue. Where in a 450-page book, the broad substance of the magazine is advertisements. Many of those same advertisements have never bought a single web property in the entire history of their brands. If you look at, like, luxury brands or take, like, an Audemars Piguet or somebody, I mean, these guys would not buy a web banner if it was the last day on Earth. And the reason is that that's this, the web is sort of this movable feast of content. You know, they're not, they don't want to buy that blind ad placement and then have that run in 10 different places, and suddenly their ad is sitting next to, you know,
some inappropriate content.
Something inappropriate. They just don't touch it. But there was something to advertisers about the magazine where when you turn that page and it's that big, beautiful two-page spread with a with an Audi that was really appealing to advertisers, and that's what I think really created the magazine. And there was something that was less true about that when you looked at a website. And so that's to say that I don't think that the website, also absent of standards, was ever at the right fidelity for all the things that makes a magazine so beautiful to work. And I think that a lot of what's happening on the web in this sort of this kind of splinter net where you have all these websites that I think are becoming a lot more beautiful and a lot more compelling and pull in all this rich media and have all these beautiful images. If you look at like the Huffington Post's approach to media, where it's very integrated and very, in some cases, very beautiful, I think they're beginning to solve those problems on the web. But I don't think that in my, and this is, I suppose, normative, but I could never fall into a publisher's website the same way I could fall into a magazine. And I think that that advertisers recognize that. I don't think people were as dedicated to the content because of the medium. And so what our hope is, and I suppose I'm placing a bet on this, is that there's something about the iPad and tablet computers that's tactile and that people like, and people like interacting with it. And there's something about the magazine and high-fidelity curated content and how that works together that makes a perfect story for this. And that means to say, if I'm really dedicated to an article in one magazine and the last page of that magazine is a spread where I can see 10 more articles, not just from that publication, maybe from that publication, maybe from another publication, maybe from a completely different vertical of content, I think that does make a pretty compelling story.
So you think the advertisers will drive the...
I think that you can't talk about magazines and you can't talk about new business models and new ways of breaking apart publications without bringing those guys to the table. So I think that the idea of being able to say, if for instance, a lot of publication websites over the last decade, about 50% of them are profitable or thereabouts, I think that can be, if you look at, I think a report was just published in the New York Times talking about, who is the survey? Of ads, the efficacy of ads on the iPad, people are more likely to pay attention to an ad because it's on an iPad, is very high. So I think if a publisher had a hard time monetizing its content outside of its book on its website, on the web, I think the rules are different on the iPad. And so maybe that's what I'm arguing for.
Thanks.
Could I just like to say that the lady in the blue will be the last question. So
actually, one other thing to build on that, like, it's not really fun to open a laptop in bed or on a plane or on the bus. So one advantage of this format is that it's just much more convenient, personal, like small, intimate to actually, I could be reading, you know, Maxim or Cat Fancy on this and you wouldn't know. Like, so there's this real
sort of...
He's
reading Cat Fancy.
I'm reading Cat Fancy. There's a much more sort of casual, comfortable aspect to this that is what's enabling it to have a broader penetration. It feels like a magazine. It feels like a book.
Sorry. Thanks. Next question, please.
So I think my question would be a good transition from the previous question.
Could you speak a little more into the mic?
Sure. My question is about what defines a digital magazine, because it looks like currently, if we look at the digital piece of the puzzle, what we call a digital magazine is really what used to be a print magazine, and it's now in a digital format. But what's the difference really between what we call now a digital magazine for the iPad and websites? So, because it's there's nothing that prevents website publishers from adding effects and publishing their websites on iPads, and you can also browse the web on an iPad. So I guess my question is, do you think in the future we'll still have this notion of magazine versus the rest of the web, or do you think we'll have just people writing content and publishing this content online?
I mean, magazines will always be, regardless of what format it comes in, whether it's a bound book or whether it's in a tablet or on an iPhone, the notion of how we conceive of magazines is basically like curated, well-edited content that's usually, you know, written or designed around some brand that we know or trust or that we as readers have an affinity for. You're absolutely, the notion of the, can websites do this? Can websites begin to rethink or reformat themselves to begin to feel like magazines? Absolutely. And we mentioned one thing earlier in the presentation. There's a app that launched to great acclaim called Flipboard, and the only unique thing about it was that it was taking what was like a fire hose of information and presenting it in a way that felt more like you're flipping through pages of a book. That was all that was really unique or novel about it. It basically took what was more information, and I mean, if we all surf the web, there are more. I think there's one stat. It was like 200 million blogs. I mean, some outrageous number of. There's so much content out there. More and more experiences are built on filtering that down and making that content something that is easy to interact with, easy to digest. And so, not only I think will we see magazines begin to reformat themselves or transform themselves to be kind of linked into websites or feel a little bit more like the digital experiences we like, we're also going to see more content reshaping itself to feel tangible, personable, warm, easier to interact with. That's another big side effect of this, of tablets, is you get a lot of websites redesigning themselves to make it easy for someone to touch, move around, browsing through this type of display.
Great. Thank you.
So I'm really interested in the relationship between brands and readers and how that's changing. Specifically, when you look at pricing, like the Financial Times, which is a newspaper, of course, costs $99 for a print subscription and $221.01 on the iPad. And so as you're seeing this change, you know, are people going to have a relationship with the brand that's across all sorts of different media, or do you think people will only read magazines on paper, or they'll read it digitally, or they'll do both?
Yeah, I mean, first thing, we have a lot of publishers that talk about print and digital bundling, and that's a publisher whose mentality is, hey, you're dedicated to our brand, you've dedicated once, and what we want to do is we want to make our content available wherever you are on whatever device that you're on and whatever platform you're on, and I think that's a really great story. And I wish that's the type, as I mean, as a, I'm kind of a digital media guy, and I mean, that's the story that I want to know. I mean, you'll look, without naming names, you know, Newsweek debuted on the iPad, and unfortunately, sans a subscription model, we're trying to sell single issues of the magazine at the print newsstand price, where you're going to pay for 50 times you're going to buy that $5 magazine, and in the print world you're subscribing for, you know, 40 or 50 bucks. I mean, it obviously doesn't work. I think that what there isn't right now is there's not a standard or an expectation for how content should be monetized on these digital devices, and there needs to be. And I think that look at what happened with iTunes. It was about selling songs. It was about 99 cents for a song. For an ebook, it had a lot to do with $9.99. Maybe somebody didn't want to pay $30 for an ebook. Maybe they wanted to pay $9.99. And I don't think really the magazine industry or we know exactly what the tune is going to be. But I definitely think it's going to need to change, and I think publishers are going to need to be more flexible if they're going to continue to grow their reach.
Thank you.
Hi. So far, most of the model in which both on tablet and online where people have consumed content is still around the magazine format. It's still I'm buying the Newsweek app or I'm looking at the Popular Science magazine. And you hinted at sort of in your presentation that maybe that people may move to sort of being interested in topics as opposed to being interested in just, oh, I want to read Newsweek now. So do you think that change is going to happen? Do you think that will erode sort of the brand of magazines sort of in the future, or do you think that the magazines sort of live on as a brand?
As we begin to Matthew's been pointing towards an interesting thing, and actually right now on Zinio you can go and read articles that they've extracted out of magazines, and you can basically kind of sample what it's like for free to read these digital magazines on an iPad. I think the notion that is really exciting is a realm where you're going to be basically experiencing stories like they are songs. Like there's so many great stories that if you only could discover them, if you only could find them, would create a much richer media experience. And I don't know if it's necessarily going to erode brands to actually be able to break stories free from magazines and read more like, if I'm really interested in stories on the BP oil spill, to kind of read that cross-section of stories across 10 different magazines. I think it's more of an additive thing. I think it'll actually lead more people back to the magazines and back to content rather than diluting the notion of what The Economist is or diluting the notion of what Esquire magazine is.
I agree. I think it's a challenge of behavioral demographics. So I think that I don't want to stand in the way of a person who likes to pick up a magazine and read it from cover to cover in a linear way. But to the broad set of digital media consumers who don't think that way and don't find content that way, I think that publications that want to continue to be relevant and make their content relevant need to appeal to people who do otherwise. And that's to say an entry point into the metaphor I use is if take a surfing magazine. If I'm going surfing in Panama in December, I'm not, unfortunately. But if I'm going surfing in Panama, and I can't subscribe to Surfer Magazine and read about surfing in Panama, but in the January 2009 edition, there's a huge, beautiful spread. It's all editorial. It's that I really want that content. Okay, I don't think that content should live at the library on a dusty shelf or in the aforementioned garage. And I think that that's something that maybe publishers can wake up to, which is that not only can the content in their current issue have greater reach if they can break it down and make it more accessible while preserving the fidelity, and that can attract readers to their brand and attract views to their advertisers if it's impressions you're looking for. And I think that looking backwards and looking at all that great evergreen content, I think that that's either a new way to monetize your content or another way to attract more readers.
Great. Thank you, Matthew. Okay, we've reached a point in our program where we have time for only one more question. I'd like to remind our audience listening at home that this is the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club. Our program tonight is iPad Revolution and the Future of Publishing. Now, our last question from the audience.
Oh, thank you. You've done a great job articulating the potential.
Can you speak into the mic, please?
You've done a great job articulating the potential future of magazines. I'd be very interested to hear what you think of the future of digital publishing of books, both fiction and nonfiction, not just from the perspective of interactive content, but from what will happen to the so-called analog book. And one example that stands out in my mind that I see on the daily commute is the Borders that's across from the ballpark is now a dugout store for World Series Giants merchandise because the bookstore went under.
Yeah, I think we both maybe answer that briefly. It was actually a really bad year for the big box stores, for Borders and Barnes & Noble, but it was a surprisingly good year for independent booksellers, and I think that tells an interesting story, which again goes back to curation. And I love books, and I love the printed word very much. I don't like this argument that the digital reading has to urgently replace the printed word. I don't think that's a necessary conversation. I don't know who's really stoking that fire. But I actually think our focus at Zinio is on high fidelity books. So we want to talk about on the iPad not just EPUBs. We want to talk about what a cookbook looks like, or a travel book looks like, or a children's book looks like, and I think that's a great story. And we have a lot of books on our platform right now. We work with Chronicle Books locally, and we're working with an increasingly growing number of books, particularly in those verticals. And it's really exciting. And I think all the things that we've said are true about books. If you're not talking about a novel, for instance, or in an EPUB format. So I'm really excited to see how the iPad can make a lot of that content sing and create readers. I know it's a passion of Matt Carlson's as well.
Well, I think one interesting thing that Matthew mentioned was the fact that like small independent booksellers are still sort of thriving, and it's all centered around that notion of like you go into someplace like the Booksmith on Haight because you know on those front tables they will have so many like fascinating things for us to discover. And it's that notion of discoverability of content again. You walk into a Barnes & Noble or Borders, and it's more of like, you know, it's back to the fire hose. Like, they've got more books and more content than I can actually understand or digest. So I think the notion of kind of that curation plus like making content more discoverable is a big central theme.
Okay, well, thank you, Matthew Davis of Zinio and Matt Carlson of Hot Studio. Our program tonight is iPad Revolution, the Future of Digital Publishing. I'm Kevin O'Malley from the Business and Leadership Forum. I want to thank our audience listening at home. I also want to thank our audience here in the Commonwealth Club for attending. And now, with this program at the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 100 years of public enlightened discussion, is adjourned.
Thank you. Thanks, everyone.